The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. Nicholas Frank is a 78-year-old retired journalist and author who lives in the little town of Eckloch in northern Germany. He's the author of multiple books, including one he just recently completed in German, Dark Soul, Cowardly Mouth. That works about the post-World War II denazification of Germany. His best-known book, In the Shadow of the Reich, that was published in 1987. And that's about Nicholas's father, Hans Frank, who was Adolf Hitler's personal attorney from 1925 to 1933. In 1939, after the Nazi machine completed its invasion of Poland, Hitler appointed Hans Frank to be the governor general over Nazi-occupied Poland. And while serving Hitler in this capacity, Frank became a noted figure within the Nazi regime and a cold-blooded murderer, a man responsible for killing countless Ukrainians, Poles, and Jews. When little Nicholas was 6 years old, his father Hans was tried and convicted at Nuremberg for crimes against humanity. Hans Frank was then executed in 1946. And today, Hans Frank is often referred to as the Butcher of Poland. His son, Nicholas, despises his father's infamous legacy and seeks to warn his own people in Germany. Nicholas Frank, thank you for joining us on today's program.
Thank you.
And we also have here with us the managing editor of the Trumpet.com website, Brad McDonald. Thank you for joining us, Brad.
You're welcome.
Well, I think where I'd like to begin, since we talked about your interview with the BBC about a month ago or so on this program, and since that time we were working to try to coordinate this interview with you, and so I've been reading a little bit of William Shirer's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, and so obviously I've gone to these sections where Hans Frank is mentioned. And this is, of course, history. This happened. This is a true record from what we know. And but when you read those sections, knowing that you were going to be joining us, the son of Hans Frank, I mean, it just made those what he did. It made it come to life. And it seems like that with your writings, you're trying to keep that warning, as I mentioned a bit ago. You're trying to keep that in front of your people so that they don't forget about it.
Yes, that's the main reason, I would say. Because, as I found out, living inside Germany and living inside the German people, I found out that the Germans in their majority never really acknowledged the crimes which we, the Germans, committed during those 12 years. And this is very dangerous for the future also of the German people. Because if you don't acknowledge something, it will again and again grow like a poisoned flower.
So maybe what we can do is we can just start chronologically, and you can begin today by telling us, I gave a little bit of rundown there in the monologue, but maybe you can tell us about who your father was and what he did.
The main profession was, in the end, started in 1939 when he became governor general. He was responsible for the civil administration, and therefore his civil administration made sure that Himmler could kill in his death camps all the innocent people. My father never really regretted this, also not during his trial. And he was a well-educated man. He was brought up as an old Catholic. He He could study law in the Weimar Republic. So he knew by soul, by heart, and by brain what's right, what's wrong. But he never did anything which would tell the people or his own profession to resign, to say what we are doing are just crimes. We are committing crimes. He knew it exactly, but his personal career was for him much more important than any morality.
And Hitler recognized this, knew that he was an ambitious man, wanted to be a successful in his career, as you said, and then he appointed him in 1939.
Yes, he appointed him because Hitler knew exactly about the weak character of my father, that my father never would really be on the opposite side of his plans to exterminate, for instance, all the Jews in Europe.
Okay, so when he gets to Poland, the Shire brings out in his book that Hitler wanted him to liquidate the intelligentsia, the leaders in Polish society. Obviously, then there were the ghettos, and maybe you could touch on what, you know, how responsible he was for those ghettos, and then of course the death camps came later as well.
He was by law, my father was by law the deputy of Hitler in the occupied part of Poland. So he was really responsible for every death in Poland during this time till the end of the war.
Which would amount to millions.
To millions, yes. And his first task was to kill the Polish intelligentsia and to make sure that the Polish people only are worth being slaves for the German industry.
And he actually wrote that in his diary, that he saw the Poles
yes,
as
one
German.
Of his, not in his diary, he delivered it in public speeches.
That they were
the
slaves.
The Polish are just slaves. Okay. We don't want to educate them, and we will only have them as simple workers.
Okay, so if you fast forward then toward the end, when he knows that Germany's losing the war, what maybe you can describe then what led up to his arrest and then the trial at Nuremberg?
Yes, he fled in January of 1945. He left Krakow because the Russians came nearer and nearer. He took with him a painting of Leonardo da Vinci, two Rembrandts, one Raphael, and really many other precious things, which were owned by the Polish state or by Jews or by Polish rich people. And he took it to Upper Bavaria, and then he waited. It's still a little bit strange for me because he had a faked passport on the name of Helmut Fischer, and he could have tried to flee to Argentina, for instance, through the so-called Red Line, built up by the Catholic Church in Rome. And he also has this capsule of cyanide, but as his secretary told me when I interviewed her, he was too much of a coward to
He had cyanide, he had a pistol you mentioned earlier,
yes.
But he couldn't bring himself to kill himself. And then I think you also mentioned earlier, before we came on the air, that he didn't flee because he thought that somehow
he handed over to the Americans who arrested him voluntarily his 42 volumes of his so-called Diensttagebuch, diary of his duties, all-day duties, which were always written down completely by two stenographers. And I think he was sure that this diary will save him, because in this diary he also mentioned his fight against Himmler. But it was not a fight to save lives. It was just who has the true power in the government general.
So they were fighting over who could be more powerful.
Yes,
in that era. Heinrich Himmler,
the reason. And on the other hand, it was the first time that in an international trial, big figures of a state were accused. And he has thought of our Emperor Wilhelm II, who was forced to emigrate to the Netherlands as the heaviest punishment.
And that's what he thought might happen to him.
I think that was the worst what would have happened to him. And suddenly he found out that he has to fight for his life.
So tell us about the Archbishop Cardinal in Munich that that loved your father.
It was Cardinal Faulhaber, who was a Nazi himself. He was very nationalistic. He thought of my father that he was a genius, because my father, when he was Minister of Justice in Bavaria, when he started in 1933, when they took over power in Germany, he helped in some ways the Cardinal and the Catholic Church. And so the Faulhaber, after the war, at first he sent his big Mercedes to the now criminals family of the Franks with a lot of food. So the Bavarians know immediately the Frank family, they are not criminals, they are really innocent people. My father was, in the meantime, he had been arrested. And on the other hand, he tried to get Pope Pius to write a letter that Hans Frank will be saved from hanging.
So your father's been arrested, and Cardinal Faulhaber thinks that he's a genius. He loved your family. He wanted to defend your family. He got Pope Pius XII to submit a letter in defense of your father.
Yes.
In the hope that he would, what, leave for Argentina or where?
No, no, no. That he, at least the most important thing is that he not will be hanged.
Mm-hmm.
But this found out the Polish delegation at Nuremberg, and they were really upset. And so immediately Pope Pius didn't write this letter.
Okay, so he backed off after the Polish delegation was against it.
So maybe you could talk a little bit more about just the Vatican's role in general in defending people like your father and then helping them travel out of the country. Was he unique in his adoration of the Catholic Church and Nazism?
No, a lot of priests and bishops and cardinals were very keen to save Nazis, and also a lot of SS criminals who ran the death camps. And there was a certain guy from Austria, Bishop Hudal, who was the chief of all those people who wanted to flee Germany, and mostly they went to South America, Brasilia and Argentina.
So why was the Catholic Church so interested in preserving these Nazi criminals?
If you would have asked them, and if they would have answered honestly, the Nazis and the Catholic Church were together in their strong anti-Semitism, that's for sure. And they all love the pure people of one skin and one face and one body. So whatever interferes in this, the Catholic Church would have hated. And so they did a lot to make sure that the ideas of the Nazi criminals and of the Nazi party will survive. And they also hoped that those persons who delivered those ideas also be alive after the war. It was another crime.
Mm-hmm. How many, for the trials that went on right after the war, how many of the top German leaders were executed, or ballpark figure?
I think it was the last one, the big first trial in Nuremberg, where the top Nazis they get hold of were sentenced. There were a lot of other trials against SS people, the big shots, and most of them had been hanged in Landsberg. It was another small town where those trials took place.
And about how many?
I don't know exactly.
Yeah.
I would say about from 50 to 100, but I'm not sure of
right.
this. But I know by a different book I have read that the Catholic Church was very, very behind those accused criminals to save them.
Right.
And to support them and to support their families and tried to minimize the guilt of those people.
And have you ever, in your research over the years, have you ever gotten a number of how many leading German officials they actually did save or rescue?
No.
Okay.
Because of the good thing for all those criminals was more and more building up of the Cold War between the East and the West, the Russian Empire, the Soviet Union, and the West. And so also our Chancellor Adenauer at this time told the Americans, if you want that we rebuild our army and if you want really to be on your side, please shut down all those trials. And so a lot of those people who got by chance life sentences or death penalties were reduced to just some years in prison. Mm. And when it came to 50, 51, in those years, they completely were, suddenly they were free people at all. Never tried again from the Germans.
Wow.
So in your opinion, how successful would denazification have been if the Catholic Church was not involved and the Vatican and top-ranking cardinals weren't facilitating Nazis escaping to South America and elsewhere?
The first thing is not so many would have saved their heads and fleeing to South America because they got from the Vatican, they got new papers, right. Really new papers, new names, new documents to have the permission to leave Italy or to leave Germany and to enter a ship and to go to South America. The other thing, I don't think that the Catholic Church, if it comes to the denazification, the Nazi members who had to go to trial for being a member and to being active in supporting the Nazi system in every position they had, they were big liars themselves, and they were strong enough. But if you look at the files of the denazification, you always find, nearly in every file, you find a letter of the priest or of the Protestant guy saying that I can swear that this guy who is now accused in his soul and in his brain, he was a completely anti-Nazi. And I can only hope that the then-called Spruchkammer, the court, who are dealing with those guys and ladies, that they will admit that he was only in the Nazi party to save his family and not being shot or being accused of something else. So there, it was a big role for the churches, and they helped a lot.
Yeah, so without the Catholic Church, denazification probably would have been a lot more successful and complete.
Yes, for sure. Because what always makes me wonder, a lie to every German member of the Nazi party had to fill a big, big formula with a lot of questions. And one of the questions, to which religion you belongs, which is really stupid, I would say, especially nowadays, but also then. And therefore, that was a hint for all the accused. Give us something from your priest. Maybe we look at another way.
Right.
Yeah. So the denazification overall didn't work very well.
It's from our historians, it's long named as was completely nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
It only sharpened the brains of the old Nazis to tell their lies very, 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 I miss the English word, that they believe it.
Yeah.
They they became really very brilliant liars from then on.
It's like they went underground, basically. And do you think they're... I mean, you sound...
No, they never went underground. Only the SS guys who really was in the concentration camps. There we had some. And also one governor, Mr. Otto von Wächter, who was a governor in the government general with my father. He went to Italy and died in the arms, by the way, in the arms of Bishop Hudal. Hmm. But the others, they didn't hide. It's one of the German characters is to obey. Mm-hmm. And at first they obeyed, but not only obeying, but by heart. They was with Hitler. They were with Hitler. And after they were suddenly the other countries who invaded the innocent Germany made them say, now it's we have to obey its democracy.
Right.
Now we will obey the democracy.
Yeah.
But they never changed their brain. And this you always see in the families. They never really talked about what they have experienced, what they have done, where they were very cowards and never did it. And this silence is what really upsets me.
And that's what's really motivated you in a lot of ways, too,
yes,
with your writings,
yes,
to
yes,
tell that history again. Because you, as you said the other night, you don't feel like even the parents are doing a good enough job teaching this to their children.
They will never do this. And they didn't. Now, a lot of the parents are dead already. But you know, if you talk to the youngsters, if you grow up in a family where there's a big silence of those dark years, yes, it hurts your character. You also become a kind of a coward. You know there is something in your family who never will be talked about, and it hurts your character. It can't make out of you a really human being. There is something left, also in the youngsters.
So going back to what's motivated you to write as you did in 1987, In the Shadow of the Reich, that was your first book, right?
Yeah.
And that's basically, well, how would you describe that book, what the contents of it?
The contents is to show the behavior of a family. It's also against my mother, this book. The original title, by the way, is The Father, a Revenge. And I told the life of my father. And I have a lot of documents showing his character. And the more I learned about my father, the more I despised him. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of lawyers inside Germany during those 12 years who went into the so-called inner emigration. And he were just silent. Then, because if you go into the resistance, you really had to fear for your life. And I didn't want that my father would have gone to the resistance, but he could make a living as a normal lawyer inside the Nazi system. And this he don't. And I wanted to show, I'm not an historian, so I wanted to show how a family is and is living during a dictatorship like this, and my father in a special way, who supported this dictatorship and very actively. And this I wanted to show also to maybe to give an example how to deal with your parents if they don't agree to open up and to tell you the truth, what they really have experienced, that they really have stolen things from the Jewish neighbors who were driven away and deported, how they really treated Jewish neighbors themselves. And this was an aim I never completed.
How was the book received when it came out in 1987?
Very badly. There was a lot of letters. One of the letters I will never forget, the guy wrote, the best thing would be we hang Nicholas besides his father.
Oh, boy.
And other death threats, which I always gave to my editor-in-chief and to the other and the publishing company. But as normal, they were cowards.
You were working for Stern at the time. That's a publication in Germany. So you were working as a journalist. You wrote this book, and it wasn't well received. And why was that? I mean, you say they're cowards. I mean, why wouldn't they receive a message like that?
Because it was written in a very foul language, I have to admit. I wanted, and it was honestly. When I sat down to write the first sentences, I didn't know how. And it came out of me. All my furious about my father and about this life he led. And so I accused him. It's the whole book is an accusation. I always addressing him, you, what? Why have you done this? Why have you been coward at this way? And this kind from till to the end. And it didn't give me some quietness, because in my brain there are still all the pictures of his victims, the children we killed and their parents we killed, innocent people, just because they were Jews. And they were so German, you couldn't imagine how German they were. They were reading Schiller and Goethe till to the end, and then they were deported just because of their face. Mm. Unbelievable. And this makes me till nowadays very furious.
So the past few years you travel around to schools and you'll read passages from one of your books, and you'll talk about some of the behavior and the actions of Nazis in World War II. You'll talk about it with children or teenagers. So what's the response when you start reading some of these stories to German children today?
The German children are, I would say, first thing, they are fed up with the Third Reich. Many lessons in the schools, they were treated with the Third Reich.
So they're tired of hearing about.
Yes, yeah. They're really tired. But when I show up with my books, which are really personal, they are very keen to hear more, because it's not only a death figure like 6 million Jews are killed, but it is Hans Frank, it is his son, it is his wife. How did they deal daily? What kind of scenes is Nicholas describing? How it was, and then suddenly it's like you see a movie. Instead of dead figures, you see a movie full of pictures. And this was really, it's always the same thing. Then they are very, very interested in, and also mostly, always, I have to say, always there's a really great discussion afterwards.
So is there a lot of empathy from the children?
I would say not an empathy. I think, and this I always have to say, no. They admire that I am such a brave guy to talk this way about his parents. But empathy is something else. When I am trying to tell them, have you ever tried to put yourself in a position that somebody urged you on a truck during a night, bringing you to a railway station together with your beloved ones and beating you up till you are in a cattle car and driving you for 3 nights and days to the east. And suddenly you are thrown out of those cattle guns. You are hungry, you are thirsty, and you are standing on the ramp in Auschwitz maybe. And then suddenly they take away your most beloved family members. Have you ever imagined this? And that they never do. And they are not taught by the teachers. The teachers are interested in, and it's also one of their duties, I admit, to tell the figures, to give them something like a frame, what was all about in the Third Reich. But they don't do this. But on the other hand, I have to say the German schools are also inviting many survivors of the concentration camps. And it's always a highlight. Also, when I am finished my lesson, mostly the teacher for history are coming to me and said, we are really thank you, because this is the way we can't do this, but you have done it, and that's great. And also later I get the mails from the wonderful feedback from the pupils.
When we come back, we'll talk more about Germany today and going back to that interview you had on BBC, I guess the comments that you made there, some of them really jumped out at us about don't trust us. All it takes is an economic downturn and history can repeat itself. So after the break, we'll get into the way it is in your country today. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back with Nicholas Frank.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong described Germany's devastating destruction in 1944 and 1945 as one of the worst beatings ever administered to any nation. Western leaders from both sides of the Atlantic assured our peoples that a demoralized Germany would never again be able to disturb the peace of the world. But while Washington and London were promising that German militarism would never again be able to strike, Herbert Armstrong was warning the world of one final resurrection of a German-led Holy Roman Empire. Only a very few listened. Mr. Armstrong said German industry and the German people's willpower and determination to work, produce, and organize was the very heart and lifeblood of all Europe.
The nations of Europe want to unite. They just don't know how to do it.
He said the prostrate body of Europe could not come back without the leadership of a revived and vigorous Germany.
And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
The world is witnessing history repeat itself one more time. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire for more on this important subject. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Welcome back to the program. Today we're with Nicholas Frank, who is the son of Hans Frank, a prominent Nazi and confidant of Adolf Hitler himself during the World War II era. And as I mentioned at the top of the program, Nicholas Frank is a retired journalist. He's written several books, and he's here today with us to tell us his story. Just to close the loop on the last thing we were talking about before the break, you had mentioned previously that your book, In the Shadow of the Reich, that when that came out in 1987, we talked already about how it was received in Germany. You also said that you distributed those or that book in Poland as well. And how was that received?
It wasn't me. It was a publishing company who mm-hmm. distributed it to Poland. And when it was published under the Polish title Moj Ojciec, my father, it was immediately bought nearly all the copies by the Catholic Church. So I didn't want a book being published in the very Catholic religious people of the Polish that has such a accusation also against the Church. And therefore, they bought all the copies.
So this is not in the late 1940s. This is in the late 1980s.
Yes,
when the Catholic Church is trying to prevent that message from going out. But you don't know how many copies they purchased.
No, I don't know how many they printed in Poland. But a small publishing company. No, I don't know.
Well, why don't we shift gears from there and talk a little bit? You mentioned you worked for Stern, the publication. Is that a weekly publication in Germany?
I was employed for 23 years with Stern magazine. Stern magazine is famous because of the Hitler diaries, which we published, and which were all fakes. And but before and also afterward, we were slightly left-winged weekly magazine. And I was there starting as an editor for German literature and then moved on being a reporter for foreign affairs, mostly wars around the world, which was a very interesting time, full of corpses, full of tortured people. Seeing how thin is in the character of the people around the world between morality and immorality. I met people who were dancing beside burnt corpses and laughing. And so I had my own experience how cruel the world can be.
So what theaters did you visit?
First Iraq War, the whole Balkan War, Cambodia, Cameroon, Namibia, South Africa, Haiti.
And so did you travel to Liberia. All those places?
Yes, I traveled. I was never based in one of those countries.
Right.
I just came together with a photographer because for Stern magazine, always the pictures were very important. The better the pictures, the more I could write. And that was the most interesting time during my life. And also I worked in Poland and Czechoslovakia when it was still under socialistic rules.
Well, maybe we could talk about the Balkan Wars for a little. So you were stationed down there in the Balkans. Do you feel, I mean, as I understand it, Germany, together with the Catholic Church, was the first to recognize Croatia breaking away from Yugoslavia. And, you know, that decision, they did that against American interests, and I think the UN was against that decision too. But eventually the UN, the United States, kind of just went along with Germany. And you know, I think you could say that Germany may have initiated a lot of that conflict through that decision. I mean, would you agree with that viewpoint?
Yes. It was especially Mr. Kohl and his Minister for Foreign Affairs, Mr. Genscher, who did it. And they are really responsible. And they forgot completely about Serbia.
Right.
Serbia were suddenly the only guilty ones.
Right.
Forgetting all the cruelties which other countries of former Yugoslavia committed. Also, they were in favor of the Kosovo, of the Albanians, who also had really committed a lot of crimes against all the others who were not Albanians. And this was not a good idea from the German politics.
So what was Germany's motive in doing that?
This I don't know. I don't know exactly.
If you look back at the history of World War II, the Germans obviously were in the Balkans, and there was a strong alliance between Germany and Croatia, and a lot of Nazis in Croatia with the Ustashi and some of these groups. I mean, do you think when Kohl and his foreign minister were making these decisions in the early 90s, they were doing it in the same spirit as that alliance between Germany and the Croats in World War II?
No, this I don't think so. No, this I don't think. I think one of the reasons may be if we acknowledge Croatia very fast, then Serbia cannot invade Croatia as the other parts of the former Yugoslavia. I think this is one of the things. And the other parts of the former Yugoslavia would follow this, which turned out was right, also Slovenia and the other parts. But it was left out completely. They took away one of the holiest places of Serbia then, through Kosovo, where this great battle, where the Serbs lost one of the holiest places in their history, is now on the Albanian side, Kosovo. And this is completely wrong. we should have invited from the very beginning also the most cruel Serbs. The Serbs army really was a cruel one, as the others of this part as well. And you know all these figures who came to trial in Denmark. Right. But we should have. The solution would always have been better if Serbia has been invited to join in. Now they will be candidates for the EU.
Right.
Very late. And on the other side is Putin fighting against it.
So as far as Germany today, you've talked before about the notion that there's two people inside of every German. Maybe you could elaborate on that first, and then we'll refer back to that BBC exchange you had a few weeks back.
Tja, I love Germany, but I don't trust my people. Again, starting from the big silence since the 8th of May in 1945, where every German forgot what he really knew about the system and what he was part of in the system. We built up a people and, more important, a really powerful economy. And this economy is hiding everything else. And you can trust the German people as long as we are rich and we have a good running economy. But as you can see, when suddenly the refugees showed up in Germany, invited through Mrs. Merkel, then the majority of the silent Germans, they showed what they really think. Mm-hmm. And this is, for me, the direct red line from our behavior during the Nazi time till nowadays. This red line is still existing, leading us to become inhuman. And this silent majority built up a pressure to the ruling parties, the Social Democrats and the Unionists. And immediately, it only lasts about 12 months, they turned around completely. We are no belonging to those countries who don't want have any more refugees. And we send them back also to the most dangerous countries, for instance, Afghanistan. And now they're talking also about Syria, to send them back, because there are some parts in Syria where it's not a war. And that is unbelievable, because the Germans should know better. We should know better, because we committed all those crimes. And in our Verfassung, I don't know, the treaty is it for the basic fundament of the state law. We call it Verfassung. It's written that we have to give every refugee, we have to give a new home. And we would have enough money to build up something like a culture, and much more important nowadays, especially after all those terroristic acts also committed in Germany by refugees. It will take a long time to change their cultural behavior and to acknowledge democracy and to also to acknowledge women and all this kind of stuff which you have in a strange culture. And we don't do it. We don't want them. And even a friend of mine who is really much more educated than me said to me about 3 months ago, many more people has to die on the sea till they really get into their brains they don't have to go to Germany. What kind of a sentence is this? He's a German, nearly my age, so he knows everything about the Third Reich. He's really educated. And this sentence also could have said my father.
Mm-hmm. But you were saying last night, though, you can understand why some in Germany would be concerned about the flood of refugees coming in and just the security of the country, given, as we saw here, even in the UK this week, just the danger of, you know, one, if one terrorist gets through, people can be murdered because of that. But what you're saying, if I get it, is that you're sensing a definite shift in the tone.
Yes.
In Germany.
Yes.
Just in the last year or two because of the refugee crisis.
Yes. And this, I always thought that Germany will become dangerous again for all the people around us, is when we have great problems with our economy. And suddenly, I was really surprised, it was the refugee problem, mm-hmm. which turned out what the silent majority really thinks. And I admit, it's really dangerous, because you never know
right.
how those people, they are, like in Manchester, this guy is born in Manchester.
Right.
You never know. But you have to deal with it. Mm. You have to deal with it.
And just to, so you can explain to our audience, when you talk about the silent majority, you're talking about the ones that should know better, that aren't saying something or aren't speaking up about that dark
the,
history? Or?
The main thing in the character of the Germans, we don't have any empathy for somebody else. We don't know. We don't have any empathy. And this also we should have educated to ourselves
right.
and to open up our brains that there are really people around the world who had not those chances the Germans got by the Allies, who liberated Germany. But if you look at the files concerning my last book, if you look at the files, not a single member of those courts, not the defending lawyer, not the accused, no, the judge was saying from the end of the Third Reich as liberation. It just was said, Umsturz, something else is coming. Never say we were liberated.
Hmm.
And this...
And so there, as you say, you're an obedient people, you go along.
Yes.
If it's democracy
and
for a while.
If we are well fed, and if our families are well off, and we all have our professions, and we have our cars, and we can have our holidays, everything is good.
And then what happens when the economic crisis
then
hits?
Then we come the, in German you say, Herrenrasse. Then the true Germans will come out of us.
And so tell us also another term you've thrown around a few times, Germany looking, when there is a moment of crisis, Germany looking for a strong man to, just like your father was back in the 1920s.
My father wrote it after the First World War in his diary. He was born in 1900, so after the war he was 18 years old. He wrote, Germany needs its honor back, and I'm looking for a strong man who rebuilt Germany as a big power, and maybe it's me. And the same words, nearly the same words, also wrote down in his diary Mr. Goebbels. And so it was, unfortunately, it was Hitler. And this is, now I lost the fun.
Well, how I guess to bring it back to today, whether it's,
For the strongman.
Yeah.
As your experiences around Europe nowadays, the people, and also you have experience in the United States with Mr. Trump, people are fed up with the political classes. It's mm-hmm. the same in Germany. It's more important in France, as you can see, and now in Austria. And Poland, unfortunately, is going backwards in a really horrible way. And also Germany, if we would have some young guy, good looking, good speaking, sportive and slim in his appearance and funny also and talking in, to the people, he would have got immediately about 30% to 40% of the election came.
So there's an appetite even now in Germany for a strong man?
Yes.
Do you see any
because
candidates?
There is some. No, I don't see anybody. We have a really unbelievable running economy. But it's we are eating our future. A lot of the people who are now working don't have any more the right to have a very good pension to live on in their age. So we are building up another silent majority who become poorer and poorer. And then you have the Germans at your throat again, if they are the really the majority. And as you know, also the middle class in Germany is going down. It's going down, and the richer become richer. And the bottom, the poorer, is enlarging more and more. And this is, especially in Germany, it will be horrible.
You think, I guess most polls are saying that Chancellor Merkel is in line to be reelected in September. I mean, do you think a strong man could come to the fore even as soon as that? Or is it
now he must show up next week, because in September we have our next election. But I don't see anybody. It must be someone like Mr. Haider was in Austria. Well, he was really good-looking guy, very friendly, very good speaker, and he had 30% of the votes.
So this is something...
And Austria is very well off. They're also rich people.
This is something, I mean, we believe the same thing and we watch for the same thing. You know, you described an individual, I think you said they would need to be eloquent, they'd have to have good humor, attractive, a captivating personality. One person we've looked at is Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, and it seems from what we've read and studied, he seems to fit the exact bill of what you described.
Maybe he was good or is good looking, but he's a boring guy.
He's boring?
Yeah, he's really boring.
Isn't he the guy that when he launched his campaign, he was on stage with AC/DC and the young Germans just loved him?
That's one thing.
Right.
But that's not the thing you really would vote for, also not in Germany. He made one good thing when he became Minister of Defense in Germany. He threw out duty, becoming a soldier for 1.5 years and so on. That made him very popular. And he was a new face. But
right.
He was never a good speaker. He was never a good speaker. So maybe in those years he would have had a chance.
Right.
Because of all the other boring politicians, he was less boring. This I would admit. But nowadays, no. You can see it. If a person has a personal authority, who is building up whenever he entering a room,
yeah,
it's something like another atmosphere.
Right.
And von Guttenberg all distributing a boring atmosphere.
So
we are looking for someone else.
But Germany is looking.
I would say so.
So when you have like the interviewer for BBC, when you said some of the statements you said, he'll come back and say, oh, what are you talking about? Germany is a beacon of moderation and tolerance and multiculturalism. How do you respond to that?
If it comes to this, the first thing I always tell, in the meantime, in the open street, Germans had beaten up 5 rabbis. One rabbi in Berlin says, in certain parts of Berlin, he won't wear his kippah because it's too dangerous. This is the first thing, and this is also the beating thing for everything else. We have nothing learned. We really have nothing learned.
You haven't learned the lesson of history, is that what you're saying?
Yes. We haven't learned out of our crimes.
We've got 45 seconds. What do you want to leave our audience with?
Watch the Germans. That's very important. And make sure that they don't become the Herrenrasse again, invading other countries.
Nicholas Frank, thanks for joining us today on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You're listening to Stephen Fleury along with, as I say, Nicholas Frank, and of course our managing editor at thetrumpet.com is here with us for today's discussion. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.